Section 4, Progress in the Countryside. As you read, look for how progressive ideas improve the lives of rural families, the rise of a tobacco culture, struggles for cotton farmers and mountaineers, and the following terms, rural free delivery and auction. Although the largest towns in North Carolina grew into cities in the early 1900s, only a tenth of the population lived in them. Most citizens still called farms or villages home, and the vast majority continued to farm. Yet farm families were increasingly drawn into the patterns of progress after 1900. Progressive ideas like ACOC, graded schools, changed some of their habits. By 1905, many received mail through rural free delivery. RFD, as it was called, brought farmers closer to urban industrial society because they could mail order goods from northern cities like Chicago and get newspapers mailed to them on a daily basis. Most rural residents no longer said they were from Smoky Hollow or Ballard's Crossroads. Rather, they hailed from Route 2 Selma or Route 3 Asheboro. More and more farmers shopped for manufactured goods at country crossroads stores, and they made fewer of their own tools and clothes. Farmers earned money to pay for all these things by growing the raw materials needed by the factories, particularly cotton and tobacco. Tobacco Road. North Carolinians became famous worldwide in the early 1900s for one thing. They made the bulk of the world's cigarettes. Smoking changed with the innovations of the Dukes. Until 1900, tobacco had been consumed in cigars, chews, or pipes. After 1900, cigarettes became the preferred choice. With the rise of the Duke family monopoly, tobacco took over the economies of the coastal plain. Even in a small county like Greene, more than 2,000 farmers grew tobacco. With this came the growth of tobacco marketing towns like Rocky Mount and Wilson. Farmers sold their leaf at warehouses in town, then the tobacco was shipped to Durham, Reidsville, and Winston-Salem. In each of these locations, thousands of North Carolinians made their living making cigarettes, and a few owners of warehouses and large farms made a fortune. The area between Wilson and Durham became known as Tobacco Road because so much leaf was shipped to the factories. The tobacco industry was one of the largest taxpayers into the federal treasury because the national government taxed tobacco as a luxury item. A new culture developed on the coastal plain around the planting, cropping, harvesting, and marketing of brightleaf. Thousands of sharecroppers, both white and black, gambled their family's future on the price of the leaf each year. Each farmer went into debt in the spring by borrowing from a merchant or banker in a nearby town to buy fertilizer and other needed supplies. The family then spent every hour they could raising as much tobacco as possible, sometimes even planting tobacco in the front yard of the house. Often, sharecropper farmers did not grow much of anything else and went into further debt buying bacon, cornmeal, and canned goods to get by. Each season dictated what a tobacco family was to do. In spring, the plants had to be set out, one by one, in the plowed rows. In summer, farmers had to remove the many baby leaves on the stem. By late summer, the harvest began, and the mature leaves at the bottom of the plant were taken off one by one. The stacks of leaves were hung on rafters in the nearby tobacco barn for curing. As one young boy in Greene County remembered, two or three of us slept on crude cots each night, each taking shifts to make sure that the fires were kept burning at the right temperature. In early autumn, the farm family took their tobacco to market in the nearby town. The tobacco was marketed at an auction, a sale to the highest bidder, in a tobacco warehouse. The sound of the auctioneer became as important to most coastal plain families as the sound of the preacher on Sunday. In a matter of seconds, the auctioneer had sold an entire year's crop to a tobacco buyer from the Piedmont factories. When the price was good, the family celebrated by buying a treat at a downtown store. When the sale went badly, they went home in as much debt as ever. And so it went, year after year. Tobacco Road counties like Nash organized their years around brightleaf. Schools, for example, were closed to let children harvest the crop. Businessmen in town anticipated being paid during market week. Warehouse owners in particular only operated for part of the year. cotton pickers, and mountaineers. Tobacco farmers were the most famous, but by no means the only farm families who still lived in the North Carolina countryside. The growth of textiles in the Piedmont pushed more and more farmers to try to make money growing cotton. To do so, more fertilizer was needed to help the poor red clay soil, and cotton farmers, like tobacco pickers, depended on a good year to get by. Cotton farming did have some good years, particularly after 1910. In contrast, prosperity eluded many mountaineer families in the early 1900s. Their families had often grown so large since the Civil War that there were too many young people for the small amount of farmable land in mountain coves. Some young men found work cutting down hundreds of thousands of acres of trees on the mountain slopes. The lumber was used by the growing furniture factories in Lenore, Hickory, and Statesville. This, however, worked against the health of their farms. With no trees left to hold the soil, erosion clogged the streams and floods ruined their fields. Thousands of mountain families left after 1900 and went to the cotton mills in places like Gastonia and Rutherfordton. Thousands of residents from the far western section of the state moved far away to the timber regions of the state of Washington. So many migrants settled north of the city of Seattle that a crossroads there became known as Tar Heel. Special feature, growing up, Barning Bacca. After tobacco farming expanded to the coastal plain in the early 1900s, Bacca became a way of life for young and old alike. For example, in 1899, farmers in Greene County planted 6,000 acres, in 1919, 15,000 acres, and in 1929, 29,000 acres. The whole household was involved in the process, and the ability of a family to survive depended on everyone working hard and often. All this work had to be done when the plant needed it, not when someone wanted to do it. The routine varied little from year to year. Tobacco seeds were planted, one by one, in a seed bed in the winter. This plant bed was covered to protect the sprouts from freezing. When it was time to transplant the sprouts, every member of the family was needed to carry each seedling to a row of earth on the blunt end of a wooden peg. This, said University Professor Howard Odom, required great care and back-bending labor. Once the plants were in the field, the really hard work began. At least six times during the season, the area between the rows had to be plowed to get air and water into the soil and nourish the plants. As the plants matured, children were sent to pinch off the buds, which made the leaves grow bigger. Children also helped with suckering the plant, removing the small leaves that grew after the larger ones were mature. During the summer, younger members of a family were sent to remove worms wherever they were found on the plant. About 3 months after transplanting, every family member was put to work priming, removing the lower leaves from the plant one by one. It usually took several weeks and as many as a dozen trips to the field to finish priming. Next, the tobacco leaves had to be cured. Children of all ages helped loop the tobacco into bunches and drape them over a stick. The sticks were then hung across poles in the curing barn. By the early 1900s, almost all tobacco farmers used the flue-cured method. A fire was built in a stove on the side of the barn, and heat was sent through the barn by a pipe. Someone had to stay up all night with the heater. Usually, older sons shared this responsibility with their fathers. Doing the job right meant constant attention to the heat of the stove and the flow of air through the barn. More than one boy who grew up on a tobacco farm later said he got his worst whooping if he let the fire go out. If the curing went too fast or too slow, the leaves were spoiled and could not be sold. At a critical moment of the drying process, the father would fix the color to give the tobacco its best flavor. If he messed up, he blistered the leaf, and again, the family would lose money. Once tobacco was cured, it was taken on the special market day to the nearest town warehouse in towns like Rocky Mount, Wilson, or Greenville. There, the grower had to pay a fee just to have the large tobacco companies like R.J. Reynolds or American bid on his crop. All the tobacco was sold at one time at an auction. It was all over for the individual farm family in less than a minute. You could always tell if the tobacco sold good, recalled the Greene County youngster. Papa would always bring something extra home for supper, like fish, cheese, or beef. If the price was bad, then Father was reluctant to give us school children a nickel for a pencil tablet or a penny for a pencil.